You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM.
Well, this is The Space Show with Andrew and Jay. Do you remember the 2013 movie called Gravity? It was rollicking good fun in an edge of your seat way.
A NORAD reports a Russian satellite has incurred a missile strike. The impact has created a cloud of debris orbiting at 20,000 miles per hour. Current debris orbit does not overlap with your trajectory. We'll keep you posted on any developments.
Should we be worried?
Well, let's let the boys down there worry for us.
In the movie, an explosive destruction of one satellite causes a chain reaction of satellite collisions.
ISS, this is Houston. Explorer, this is Houston.
Go ahead, Houston.
Mission abort. Repeat. Mission abort. Initiate emergency disconnect from Hubble. Begin re-entry procedure. ISS, initiate emergency evacuation.
Copy all, Houston, end in work. Matt, immediate return to Explorer. Repeat. Immediate return to Explorer.
Copy. Explorer, prep airlock.
Airlock engaged. Ready to receive.
Houston, elaborate.
Debris from the missile strike has caused a chain reaction, hitting other satellites and creating new debris. Traveling faster than a high-speed bullet up towards your altitude. Now copy.
Copy all.
I'm sorry, I'm done.
All right, Sharif, let's do this.
Roger, Matt.
Houston, update?
Well, we have a full-on chain reaction. It's been confirmed that it's the unintentional side effect of the Russians striking one of their own satellites.
They shut down their own satellite.
Right at disposal. Most likely a spy sat gone bad. Now it's shrapnel. Explorer ready to disengage HST.
Explorer, new data coming through.
What's the blowback, Houston?
It's not good. Most of our systems are gone. Debris chain reaction is out of control and rapidly expanding. Multiple satellites are down and they keep on falling.
Define multiple satellites.
Most of them are gone. Telecommunication systems are dead. Expect a communication blackout at any moment.
Kowalski visual of debris at 9 o'clock.
Half of North America just lost their Facebook.
Explorer, repeat. Expect a communication blackout at any moment.
Copy that, Gibson.
Debris is from a BSE sat. Repeat, I have...
Dr. Stone requesting faster transport.
We have to go.
Kennedy reports meteorological conditions. No go.
Oh! Unstrap. Look, we need to get the hell out of here.
Need some help there, man.
No, don't wait for us.
It's stuck.
Man down.
Houston, this
man
is
down.
Copy.
He's off structure. Dr. Stone, he's off structure. Dr. Stone, detach. Must detach.
Whilst most of the movie was plain silly, at its core was a kernel of truth. There is a growing risk that, with the increase in the number of satellites and associated debris, there could be collisions between satellites. This would create more debris, which, in turn, would lead to more collisions. And more debris, and so forth. Whilst this runaway effect would not occur in the minutes shown in the movie, it could occur over months or years. This cascade could render some orbits unusable. One type of orbit that is particularly at risk is the low Earth orbit that is sun-synchronous. The world's space agencies are now seriously worried about this risk and are now taking steps to prevent a gravity-like scenario from happening. Not that the idea of satellite collisions is new. Take, for example, this news report from 1968 April.
There's been a traffic collision in outer space. It's just been revealed that two unmanned American satellites collided last year, but survived the crash and are still orbiting. The disclosure was made by Dr. Hilliard Page, Vice President of the General Electric Company, at the 17th Astronautical Congress in Madrid yesterday. He said it's the first known case of a collision in outer space in a rush hour.
When the space age began in 1957 with the launch of Sputnik 1, the idea that satellites might collide seemed quite preposterous. After all, space was vast. At first, tracking space objects be it active satellites or defunct satellites, rocket bodies or debris, this was the task of amateurs.
Okay, amateur astronomers in various parts of the world, including those that are using the new observatory in Christchurch, are constantly passing on their satellite observations to the Astrophysical Observatory of the Smithsonian Institute in the United States. The information finds its way to the Moonwatch division of the observatory, the head of which is at present visiting Christchurch. Here's Mr. W.P. Hurst, and he was asked by John O'Sullivan to explain the work of the organization.
Moonwatch is an organization of amateur visual satellite observers that was formed by the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory of Cambridge, Massachusetts, USA, right at the beginning of the satellite era. These fellows, they occur either in groups or single observers. They observe satellites with particular reference to the position in the sky of the satellite at an exact time. Then they report these observations to Smithsonian, who of course send them the predictions that enable them to make them.
What is the particular role of the Christchurch team? Do we have any particular importance, or do we just fit into the general pattern?
You just fit into the general pattern, but as a team in the Southern Hemisphere, you have a greater importance than most, simply because there are so few teams in the Southern Hemisphere. If you take a look at the globe, you'll see that the Southern Hemisphere is mostly water. And, well, you just happen to stick out through the water.
You're so involved with the Moonwatch program. Have you any great ambitions to land on the moon yourself?
Oh, I'd love to. Always provided I can make sure of getting back.
Mr. W.P. Hurst, head of the Moonwatch division of the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory.
This is The Space Show, which is presented by members of the Space Association of Australia.
Southern FM. The sounds of the Bayside.
And before our station announcements, we heard a report there from the NZBC, dated from 1966. Well, very quickly, the main organisation tracking satellites was the North American Air Defence Command, NORAD. Now, NORAD later passed this task to Spacecom. Now, to date, they have put 43,700 objects into their catalogue and are reported to be tracking thousands of smaller objects they don't bother to catalogue. Of course, not all of these objects are still in orbit, but tens of thousands are. In 1994, Bob Thibault sent The Space Show this story, which he titled Space Cleaner Than Thought.
NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, presents The Space Story. There's air pollution, there's water pollution, and for the past decade or so, another worry has been added to the list, space pollution. An estimated 5 million pounds worth of dead satellites, rocket fragments, and other assorted junk now circle the Earth. You would think the space shuttle would have a hard time dodging all that trash. In fact, shuttle windows have to be replaced routinely due to damage from tiny debris particles in orbit. Fortunately, the big hazards are very few and very far between, and space is very big.
Picture yourself sitting on your porch in the summertime during a rainstorm watching a bumblebee fly around. You see them fly all the time, when what they're basically doing is they're flying between the raindrops. If a bumblebee were to be struck by one of those raindrops, it would be knocked senseless. Yet it does, you know, you see them whizzing around. Well, that's basically what happens in space. These satellites are flying between the debris, but if any given satellite or an object were to be struck by a piece size of a pea or larger, it would be destroyed.
It's never happened, but it could, says George Levin, NASA's Orbital Debris Program Manager. So part of his job is figuring out how much junk is up there, where it's located, and what can be done to avoid it. In the past, most of the debris has come from explosions of used rockets in space. Rocket vehicles typically carry along extra fuel as a hedge against possible errors in the launch trajectory. But more often than not, the fuel just goes unused.
This excess fuel, when left on these upper stages, represented sort of a ticking time bomb. Over time, the stages would degrade and the fuel and the oxidizer would mix and you'd have an explosion. Instead of having one large piece of debris, you'd suddenly have millions of pieces of debris.
Recognizing the problem, the world's space launching nations agreed to do what they could to stop creating new debris. The extra fuel is now either vented into space or burned away. Deliberate destruction of satellites for military tests also has stopped. Add to this the natural cleansing of debris by the thin upper atmosphere, and the problem appears to be getting much better. How do we know? Levin's group has spent 3 years using the powerful Haystack radar in Massachusetts to build up a statistical estimate of the total number of debris objects in orbit. The radar concentrates on particles ranging from 1 to 10 centimeters in size, between the size of a pea and the size of a softball.
The reason we pick that size is greater than 10 centimeters, we can track them and we can catalog them, so we maneuver out of the way. Less than 1 centimeter, we can protect with them with the normal bumper shields. So these objects that are too large to be protected against but too small to be seen represent a risk, and we call them the risk objects.
The radar studies are encouraging. The number of risk objects in low orbit appears to be only half of what was predicted 10 years ago. That's particularly welcome news for engineers building the space station, says Levin. It means the chance of collision with one of these risk objects over the station's lifetime will be extremely low, and protecting against smaller debris will be easier. One way is to attach additional shields to vulnerable areas, such as the astronaut living quarters.
You have objects that are traveling at very, very high speed. So what you want to do is you want to put up a very thin shield that stands away from the body you're trying to protect, which in this case might be the living quarters. When one of these debris objects strikes the shield, it's traveling so fast that it fragments and actually melts. And so what you end up with is, instead of a single piece hitting the living quarter, you end up with it striking the shield, fragmenting and melting, and then deposits as almost a spray over the outside of the crew quarters, which has absolutely no effect.
There's still a lot of work to be done, says Levin, but for now, the cleanup strategies seem to be working. Thanks to international cooperation and a quick response, space is actually a lot less dirty than it used to be. This has been the Space Story, brought to you by this station and NASA. For the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, I'm Bob Tebow.
And we thank Bob for that report from 1994. And that space station, well, it's now in orbit and it's been there 20 years this week. And so far, it has not had a major collision with any debris, although it has a few times had to dodge bits of junk. Now, unfortunately, since that report that Bob filed, China has carried out an anti-satellite explosion and an American Iridium satellite collided with a Russian Cosmos satellite. Each event created hundreds of fragments, each whizzing around our planet at 28,000 kilometers per hour. On last week's program, we noted that when Rocket Lab launched satellites from New Zealand, the final rocket stage deployed a sail with the aim of hastening the decay from orbit of the rocket.
Now the final payload on its business time is the Nabeo drag sail from HPS of Munich, Germany. The Nabeo is designed to help passively deorbit satellites at their end of life by increasing the amount of drag the spacecraft experiences. This lowers the spacecraft's altitude and drags it back into the Earth's atmosphere, where it burns up on re-entry. Innovations like this will play a significant role in reducing space junk in low Earth orbit. For today's mission, Nabeo will be hosted on the kickstage, but will not separate from the vehicle.
Sitting on the launch pad at the Vandenberg Air Force Base in California right now is a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket. It was supposed to have been launched yesterday, Australian time. That has been delayed to allow additional pre-flight inspections of the rocket. One of the many small satellites resting inside the Falcon 9's payload fairing is the European Student Earth Orbiter. This is a European Space Agency project.
University student teams around Europe have been busy in the last months as they have made the final preparations for ESAO, the European Student Earth Orbiter. ESAO is part of the ESA Academy's hands-on programs preparing the space workforce of tomorrow. The student teams have designed, constructed, and tested essential parts for the mission, including subsystems, instruments, and ground control stations. After its launch, ISAO will be released into a polar orbit. Now the focus is on the ISAO mission to start. It will be launched on the 19th of November to low Earth orbit. The students will then be busy with the operations of the satellite at least until the end of 2019, when the last experiment aboard will be activated. The deorbiting experiment by the Cranfield University in the UK will deploy a lightweight, large sail to accelerate ISAO's re-entry and burn-up in the atmosphere at the end of the mission.
Did you catch the mention of a deployable sail built by students and staff at Cranfield University in the United Kingdom? It consists of four aluminized capstan sails, each of area 1/8 of a square meter. They will be held out by four booms made of copper beryllium alloy. Again, these sails will increase drag and speed up their decay from orbit. The growing urgency of proliferating space junk has not escaped Australian attention. Peter Nikoloff works at the Adelaide company called Nova Systems. Alice Gorman is from the Adelaide-based Space Industry Association of Australia.
Pete Nikoloff here. I've got another point on some of the defence-related issues, if you'll...
Okay, Peter. Welcome, Peter, from Nova Systems in Adelaide.
Yep. So, on some of the defence-related and national security aspects, in 2010, Australia and the US signed a Space Trials Awareness Agreement. And that agreement has resulted in two projects where they've moved a US space surveillance radar to the West Coast, and in coming years they'll install a space optical telescope. Now, even though they're US assets, Australia's actually invested in operating and supporting these assets. And so a result of that is we get shared information. So that's an example where our investment in these projects will help. But what we really need in the future is the radar is quite old technology, and Australia does some great work on phase-way radar. So follow-on projects, we should be looking at upgrading that radar system to the state-of-the-art using Australian technologies and a space agency and R&D programs and things in related areas with defence certainly help that. And that would, again, give us more leverage into access to US data if we're a big contributor. So that's another example project where we are reliant on that. So that space surveillance stuff has two main roles. One is just tracking all the space junk, which is critical to the safety of everyone's satellites, and also tracks a lot of foreign countries' assets as well, tracking over our part of the world. So it's important. We are valuable because we're providing Southern Hemisphere data, which the US don't have that at the moment. So that's an example of some of the national security aspects and working together with the US, for example.
And that space surveillance and space situational awareness is an area that we have a lot of expertise in, not only because we have antennas that can gather data on the Southern Hemisphere, but we have a major practical industry and research project based at Mount Stromlo in the ANU, which is using lasers for tracking space junk. And this is both making a technological contribution to a global problem that has to be solved for everybody to maintain access to space services, but because Australia is, because of its large landmass and sparse population in remote areas, we're particularly vulnerable if we lose access to these. So we have a large interest in keeping space safe, and this is something that, even though we're already participating and contributing to this, this is something that could be more effectively promoted with a space agency that, for example, could become a member of the Interagency Space Debris Coordination Committee. Since we don't have an agency, we can't contribute to policy at that international policy and regulation at that level yet.
Yeah.
The other important point in this area is that the Department of Defence are investing billions of dollars into that space situational awareness over the next decade. Now, if we align with what we've done in the past, typically we just throw all our money offshore and say, US provide big expensive systems or Europe or whatever, provide all these capabilities. Even though we acknowledge we can't develop all this stuff in country from scratch, we need to make sure we've got involvement and participation in Australian industry and research agencies with elements where we can really add value and make sure we can best utilise these sensors. So it's important that we, between Defence and the Space Agency, we do coordinate and encourage maximum Australian participation for long-term national security reasons.
Closer to home, the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology University has a space research centre that is considering ways to manage the space environment. At the Australian Space Research Development Conference, Robert Norman described their activities.
I'll talk a little bit about the CRC for Space Environment Management, which is managed by the Space Environment Research Centre. And then I'll just give a brief overview of the project. Okay, the CRC for Space Environment Management, as I mentioned before, it's managed by the Space Environment Research Centre, CERC, and it was established to build on Australian and international expertise in measurement, monitoring, analysis and management of space debris and to develop technologies to preserve the space environment. And the real goal is to remotely manoeuvre space debris using photon pressure from a ground-based laser. So that's the ultimate goal. And the partners, EOS, RMIT and ANU, and there's Lockheed Martin and Optus, etc. It's a 5-year project, and the funding for it is $60 million in cash and in kind. So it is a major project. Now, I'll talk a little bit about the space debris. Space debris, as we most know, is just defunct man-made junk up in space. And basically, the current environment. In the current environment, there's around about 19,000 plus, more than 19,000 objects in that up in space that are more than 10 centimetres in diameter, and another 500,000 objects which are greater than 1 centimetre in size, and tens of millions of objects which are less than 1 centimetre in size. And there's over 1,000 operational satellites up in space. And the figure there is just of Vanguard 1. It's one of the oldest known pieces of space debris. It was launched in 1958 and it was no longer operational in 1964. It's still up there. And space before 1957, well, it was pretty much squeaky clean. 1970, you can see the space is starting to be contaminated with debris. 1990, 2000 and 2014. One of the problems with the debris is that it's moving so fast, and it can be moving at 8 kilometres a second. It can really make an impact on whatever it hits, and as the debris gets more and more, the space becomes more and more dangerous. There's people up there, living up there in the space station, and there's a lot of infrastructure up there, communication infrastructure, defence, weather satellites. And there's a whole host of things that we rely on. And as we get more and more collisions and more objects are placed up there, yeah, it's becoming a more dangerous place. Now, the problem, Chinese anti-satellite mission where they blew up one of their own satellites, and the black circle just shows the increase in the debris from the Iridium Cosmos collision. So two major satellites. One was defunct, but they crashed into each other at almost right angles, but at a speed of around 11 kilometres a second. This figure here just shows the collisional cascading, so it's just the projected amount of orbital debris resulting from the Kessler syndrome. His space flight is stopped for the next 200 years. And you can see that even if the space flights are stopped from collisions in those regions, there's still going to be an increase in the debris. So if we can reduce the number of collisions or develop techniques where we can have collision avoidance, then we can start to reduce the number of debris. Now, the research programs. There's four research programs in association with the CRC for SEM. Research Program 1 is led by Dr. Craig Smith from EOS, and it basically involves the tracking of space objects to better monitoring and cataloguing of space debris using adaptive optics and lasers and a combination of optics and lasers. I lead Research Program 2, where we're looking at producing higher accuracy orbit predictions and as well as developing new models of atmospheric mass density. And Dr. James Bennett leads Research Program 3, and he's developing global space catalogues and distribution system, having conjunction analysis and threat warnings. And Research Program 4 is led by Matt Bald from Lockheed Martin, and this program will engage space objects using photon pressure with a view to establishing momentum transfer and force models for the interaction between the space objects and the propagated energy. Up to 3 dedicated satellites will be designed and launched into orbit to serve as instrument platform targets. So if we just assign a word to each of these, it'd be RP1 would be tracking, RP2 would be orbit, RP3 would be collisions, and RP4 would be manoeuvre. And if we want to manoeuvre an object, we first have to be able to identify it and track it. And then we have to be able to, because they're moving so fast, we have to have accurate orbit prediction techniques. So we have to be able, that's where the RP2 comes into it. And if we manoeuvre an object, we have to know if where we're manoeuvring it to, that we don't want to manoeuvre an object into the path of a satellite that could be worth hundreds of millions of dollars and wipe it out. So that's where we have the collision assessment as well. And also in RP4, we need to know the interaction between the space object and the propagated energy. So in order to manoeuvre a debris object, we have to be successful. We have to have made a lot of success in each of these research programs.
That was Robert Norman from RMIT Space Research Centre, which, of course, is at RMIT University right here in Melbourne.
Hi, this is Mark Holden, and you're listening to 88.3 Southern FM.
We pointed out earlier in this program that tracking space debris quickly moved beyond the capabilities of amateurs and became the purview of the military. They now call what they do space surveillance. Here in Australia, the Defence Science Technology Group has a strong interest in keeping tabs on what's up there in space. Dr. Gordon Fraser is research leader at the DST group and gave this oversight of their interest and activities to the Australian Space Research Development Conference.
Thank you for coming. As he said, I'm going to speak about a wide field of view sensing system that we've developed, although we did it for other purposes, and perhaps I'll allude to those as we go on. All right, so I wanted to cover three things. Most of the work is on the third topic, but the first two I think are worth covering because certainly I think I've got a perhaps unusual perspective from what you might have first imagined. So first question, why should we do space situational awareness or surveillance of space? I'll use the terms interchangeably. Well, I think it's almost self-evident. There's lots of stuff above us. We need to know what it is. We spend a great deal of effort understanding what the air picture, what aircraft and so forth are, you know, flying around us and near us. And we also need to spend effort in understanding what people have put in orbit above us. So that's the first thing. The second thing is we put our own assets in space, so we need to be able to manage those. We need to know where they are in order to talk to them and for them to do the things that we wish for them to do. There's this notion of a good international citizen. You can imagine a middle power like Australia being able to perhaps provide independent statements about the presence of activities in space and perhaps remind you of the 2009 Chinese anti-satellite test, where at least for a few days it was unclear what had happened, and until China announced what it had done, it was turning into a kind of, you know, US-China debate about what had gone on. So I think there's a real role for, you know, middle powers, small powers like Australia, having something to say about what's going on above us. The next one's launch services. Now, we don't do a lot of launch in Australia, but we do do some launch. I've personally been involved in some extent to maybe six or seven launches now. Generally, I'm downrange and the things fly over me, so I'm ever hopeful that they don't fall short. But, you know, you can't put things in space without knowing what's already up there. I mean, it'd be enormously embarrassing, of course, if you put a sounding rocket into the space station by accident. Imagine, you know, explaining that one away. The other one is collision avoidance. There is this question of, as more and more assets go up there, how do you stop them banging into each other? And then that follows on to this idea of Kepler effect and so forth, where you can get this cascading collision debris creation that may render space unusable or difficult to use. So there's the sense that it's a fragile resource. It's one of the commons, like air and water, that we need to preserve in some way. And understanding what's up there is a key part of that story. And then I guess the other thing that, you know, as we start to put CubeSats and all sorts of other things up there, we have to think about what happens when these missions run out. You can't just leave stuff there. You know, we are good neighbours. So there's a whole challenge of end-of-mission management, including potentially deorbit. So you need to understand what's up there, what your things are doing, in order for you to behave in a reasonable, good citizen type way. And then the final one, of course, is it's just interesting to try and understand what's up there. It's an interesting technical challenge. So let me give you a little historical context. Obviously, satellites, the usual stuff, you know, for communications, for intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, for remote sensing, for navigation and for timing, and general scientific payloads. But I draw you now back to, you know, let's return to the late 50s for a moment. In the early 50s, there was an attempt by the US to President Eisenhower, actually, to create what he called an open skies policy, where you could fly your reconnaissance aircraft over the other people and so understand what they were up to, and that would hopefully diminish the threat of what at that time was increasingly looking like nuclear war. I draw the contrast between Sputnik and the act of trying to fly aircraft over another territory. So trying to fly aircraft over, people are trying to shoot you down. And indeed, we saw that with the Gary Powers shoot down in 1960. But of course, Sputnik goes up 3 years earlier, and everyone thinks it's a great idea. It can fly over your head. No one's trying to shoot it down. And it really creates this difference between space objects freely able to fly above you and apparently with no concern, and air-breathing aircraft flying above you, which you did everything that you could to get rid of. It's worth noting that there is now an open skies policy or treaty for aircraft, but it was, you know, created in 1992 and ultimately signed in 2002. So, you know, contrast the satellite circumstance. You can put up a satellite, it can fly anywhere. Apparently that's of no concern. We're trying to do the same with aircraft, in which case it's a very difficult thing to do at all. And I think a side part to this is this idea of verification for deterrence. So the idea was you are less likely to start an end of world type war if you have some understanding of what the other people are up to. And so there was this challenge between space objects flying above, attempting to disrupt them, but not really, because in fact they were a stabilising influence. Step now into the idea of what is really strategic defence or missile defence, we'll call it missile defence. Through the late 50s, early and mid 60s, culminating in probably the early mid 70s, a lot of effort was spent on missile defence. That is the attempt to defeat incoming strategic strike, either the Soviets attacking the US or vice versa. And a lot of technology was developed at that time, which has direct relevance today in this surveillance of space mission. And in fact, what you see is that when you're building sensors for these other roles, most of the time you're actually looking at space objects because they're great calibration sources, they're great testing of your equipment sources and so forth. So the two missions are coupled tightly. From that work, we got, I guess, two things that I wanted to draw. One was the phased array radar, So that was this idea of an agile, very effective radar for observing what is above the Earth. As I said, you can use it for surveillance of space most of the time. And the other thing was this idea of classes of weapons, in particular nuclear weapons in space. And so the early anti-ballistic missile systems, unlike the ones that you hear about today, were actually nuclear devices. Those operating outside the atmosphere were optimised to generate X-rays to destroy weapons, and those inside the atmosphere were optimised for neutron, like the classic neutron bomb. Now, obviously, you know, that meant that in the late 60s, early 70s, things were becoming very, very difficult in terms of nuclear weapons all over the place, including in space. And we've seen this significant direction of weaponization, although with the Outer Space Treaty in 1967, there was kind of a change in direction and people moved away from that. And I think that was motivated by the recognition that you needed to understand what the other guys were doing, and to disrupt that made things less stable, not more stable. But I want to draw you to the point that all of these things existed in the 60s and 70s, and they're only not there today because of treaty. And so what happens if treaties fail? Okay, so here's another significant application for the need to understand what is above us. So I want to point out, you know, treaties do fail. Look at the anti-ballistic missile treaty signed in 1972, and we see today that 2002, that's no longer in effect because the United States stepped away from it. So they did that, and they did it for a purpose. They've now breached it, not that it's breached because they're obviously not party to it anymore, but they've exceeded its limits in terms of mobility of interceptors, speed of interceptors, and power of the radars that they use to observe the incoming thing. So again, there's this relationship back to sensors for looking as to what is above us. So what does the future hold? Well, more of the same, of course. The future is always more of the same. We're going to see a sophistication in this management of what is in space above us. So rather than integrated air pictures for aircraft and so forth, that's going to extend to include things above 100 kilometres, so this notion of integrated aerospace and missile defence systems. Obviously SmallSat, and you know, as I said here, you think drones are annoying. Well, I have a drone, so for those drone people out there, don't spam me. But we're going to see lots and lots and lots of satellites, and that's going to bring its own challenges as well. Australia itself has to become sophisticated in the way it conducts itself in this way, and we're going to see launch services increase in Australia. I mentioned there's been 6 or 7 or 8 launches over the last decade or so. That's going to increase significantly. And there's obviously the fact that I think Rocket Labs, for example, are talking about $4.9 million to insert something into orbit. That's an order of magnitude less than to do so otherwise. But going forward, we've got these difficult notions like, you know, countering objects that are in space. So the intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance satellites that are up there, people will attempt to counter them. We're going to see cyber and electronic warfare effects applied to satellites, so attempts to manipulate communications protocols, attempts to damage or blind or manipulate the sensors themselves. We're going to find that satellites are going to have to require some form of self-defence. It's straightforward to place one satellite near another satellite to activate, perhaps for nefarious purposes at any time. We've got to admit the possibility that there will be a weaponisation of space. We've seen treaty failure. I mentioned the ABM treaty. It could happen with other treaties as well. And there's all these technologies that are coming forward that all have application in space. ASAT, anti-satellite, it's an interesting history there. First anti-satellite systems in the 70s. We've seen a range of developments. In the 80s, we've seen ASAT systems launched from aircraft. Russia today has some co-orbital ASAT systems. And of course, 2009, we saw the Chinese destroy a satellite in space. And 18 months later, we saw the US equally destroy a satellite in space. So I guess don't say there's not an arms race.
Bringing part one of our space show series on space surveillance to an end, that was Dr. Gordon Fraser, the research leader of the DST group, the Defence and Science Technology Group, speaking at RMIT. Part two next week, and also the 50th anniversary of ALDO, the Europa 1F7 failed to orbit 50 years ago, that attempt from Woomera. We'll be about that next week. But right now, we're handing over to Nick Black and Purple Haze. I'm Andrew Rennie. On control, we've had Jay.